orders. One activity we were looking forward to was riding the Cuyahoga Valley Scenic Railroad. It's one of the oldest, longest, and most scenic tourist excursion railways in the country. Running 51 miles from Independence, Ohio, through the park, and continuing to Akron and Canton. You can board the train at the north end of the park at Rockside Station, get off at stops throughout the park, and reboard later for the return trip. But when we asked a ranger about the train, he told us that it doesn't run on Mondays or Tuesdays, the only days we're here. Since we'd planned a whole day around riding the train, we found ourselves with time to fill. We asked the rangers for recommendations of things to do. One of them suggested we go to the beaver marsh at dawn or dusk to see beaver activity. They are understandably proud of their beaver activity, because by 1900, there were almost no beavers left in the Cuyahoga Valley due to unrestricted hunting. The ranger told us beavers created a marsh on top of what was previously an automobile junkyard. We were expecting to hear a feel-good story about how the Park Service removed the trash and restored the area to its natural state, but the beavers moved too quickly. They took matters into their own paws, dammed the stream, and created a marsh on top of the junked cars. Today, instead of riding the train, we hiked to Brandywine Falls and then the Ledges and Pine Grove trails. It was hot and humid again, temps in the 90s. The Ledges Trail is an easy 2.2-mile loop through a hemlock forest that passes by several 30 to 60-foot tall sandstone cliffs, the ledges. It also goes by Icebox Cave, which isn't a real cave, but a 50-foot-deep narrow slit in the rock hillside. At the entrance, we felt cold air coming out of the cave. It would have been the perfect day to sit inside. I peered into the darkness. "Let's go in and look around," I said to Matt. "Do you have a flashlight?" Matt shrugged his shoulders. He hates caves. "I know you have a flashlight. For God's sake, you have everything from batteries to a tick remover. Surely you have a flashlight." He replied, "Do you have a tick that needs removing?" "Come on. You could supply a medical clinic with what you have in your backpack. Do you really expect me to believe you don't have a flashlight?" He said, "Look, it would be easy to hand you my flashlight, but then you wouldn't have learned anything. We're in a national park. You need to work on your survival skills. Take those two Corona Light bottle caps out of your backpack and try rubbing them together to get a spark. Use your dirty Kleenex as kindling." Matt never wastes an opportunity to point out my lack of preparation. Just then, 20 kids, who looked to be about fourth grade age, arrived and swarmed the area in and around the cave. One of them ran right into Matt, got behind him, and grabbed Matt's legs. He was hiding from his friends behind Matt like Matt was a tree. The kid peeked around Matt's backpack, then ran away with a squeal. Matt was momentarily trapped in the scrum of children. I continued down the trail. "See you back at the car, honey." We thought about renting bikes and then riding along the towpath trail, but it was too hot. The towpath trail is the same path that mules once walked while towing canal boats along the Ohio and Erie Canal. The canal was a 308-mile waterway built in the 1820s to carry freight, but the arrival of railroads made it obsolete, which explains why the part of the canal we saw looked like a ditch choked with weeds. It's hard to imagine boats filled with cargo ever using this as a means of transportation, but they did. 20 miles of the trail run through the park, and it's usually crowded with walkers, runners, strollers, and bicyclists. More than 2.2 million people annually, but very few of them were out today. After looking through the newsletter and map for the 10th time, We realized we were running out of things to do. I talked Matt into visiting Hale Farm and Village, an outdoor living history museum depicting life in the mid-1800s, by telling him they have farm animals he can pet. I neglected to mention that they have crafts like broom making, basket weaving, candle making, butter churning, and spinning. And you can tour historical houses with interpreters dressed in period costume. Matt isn't a fan of crafts or places where people dress in costume and reenact history. He tries to trick them into coming out of character by asking questions like, "Do you have a website that tells more about your village?" It didn't matter anyway. When we got there, we learned that Hale Farm is also closed on Mondays and Tuesdays. We chose the worst 2 days of the week to visit the park. We ended up at the Winking Lizard Tavern in Peninsula, Ohio, a small historic town in the middle of the park. Between yesterday and today, we've been there 3 times. They're currently hosting their 24th annual World Tour of Beers. A tour card electronically keeps track of the beers you've consumed, and when you've had 100 beers from their World Tour of Beers list, you receive the coveted World Tour jacket. If we were spending a few more days in the park, we'd wear our World Tour jackets back to Seattle. But tomorrow we're heading home. Your friend, Karen.
From Matt Smith. Subject, number 5. Rocky Mountain National Park. Date, July 21st, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, visiting Rocky Mountain National Park today brought back memories from when our kids were young and we spent summer vacations in Estes Park. They always enjoyed the town of Estes Park more than the national park. It's hard for rocks, trees, and tundra to compete for a child's attention when there are go-karts and a giant slide close by. I came here as a kid myself. It was my introduction to the national parks. Then, in the 1970s, tourists swarmed Colorado. Developers, it seemed, built as many condominiums as they could get away with, something John Denver could not comprehend, to accommodate the crowds. Against this backdrop, the park became a safe base for people who valued wilderness. Build your golf courses, ski slopes, and Olympic villages along the I-70 corridor, but leave Rocky Mountain National Park unspoiled. We drove through the park on Trail Ridge Road, entering from the east. The road climbs to the Continental Divide before it bends south to the town of Grand Lake. Workers were repaving the road, so alternating directions of traffic had to take turns going around them. The drive was slow as we climbed to nearly 12,000 feet. Being so high, the road is above the tree line for a long stretch. One of my favorite family photos is of the kids and me above the tree line along Trail Ridge Road, with the mountain peaks in the background and clouds below. It looks like we just climbed to a remote summit instead of driving there in a minivan with a Fievel Goes West videotape playing in the back. Halfway through the park, at the Alpine Visitor Center, we stopped and stamped our passports. At the stamp station, a man wearing a Kansas State T-shirt stood uncomfortably close to me and stared at what I was doing. He watched me stamp my passport, as if I was one of the park's interpretive exhibits. I looked up at him, thinking he wanted to use the stamp or maybe say hello. Why else would he be invading my personal space? Then he just walked away without grunting a word. From the visitor center, we drove toward Grand Lake. Along the drive, we saw elk, sometimes in the distance and sometimes near the road. In a couple of places, they were so close that people stopped their cars to take pictures. One man turned off his car in the middle of the road, got out, and left his driver's side door open. Oncoming traffic had to drive onto the shoulder of the road to avoid hitting the door. He walked about 30 feet into the grass and stood with his hands on his hips, looking at the elk while traffic piled up behind him. "Bob, By any chance, were you in Rocky Mountain National Park today? We exited the park at the southern end and entered the town of Grand Lake, where we're staying for 2 nights. There we could see the widespread damage from the ongoing pine beetle epidemic. It's shocking. Huge areas of pine forest are dying, and it's happening from Mexico to Canada. The Park Service newsletter says, "There is no effective means of controlling a large beetle outbreak in such a vast area as the park's backcountry, which comprises about 95% of the park." The National Park Service's efforts are limited to trying to keep the trees alive near facilities such as visitor centers and campgrounds. Enough with the beetles. Tomorrow we hike. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, Rocky Mountain, Day 2. Date, July 22, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, today's main activity was an 11-mile round-trip hike to Lone Pine Lake, starting from the East Inlet Trailhead on the west side of Rocky Mountain National Park. A park ranger stood at the entrance of the trail checking hikers on their way in. He was making sure no one was bringing a dog with them on the trail, and that everyone was wearing appropriate footwear and clothing. We've seen people wear crazy stuff on hiking trails. I once saw a woman on Tiger Mountain, a half mile from the summit, hiking in flip-flops. There was 6 inches of snow on the ground at the time. I'm sure the ranger turned a few hikers away today. But not us. He deemed our clothing appropriate and wished us a pleasant day. About a mile into the hike, we saw two foxes standing on the trail about 30 yards ahead of us. Their coats were thick and fluffy, like they just had a bath. We haven't seen many foxes in the wild to compare them with, but these two looked very healthy. They didn't seem concerned that we were there. They looked at us and calmly continued on their way. Another mile or so down the trail, a yellow-bellied marmot ran across our path and hid among the rocks. I tried to get a good look at him, but he was better at hiding than I was at finding him. I'm 49 years old, and as of a month ago, I'd never seen a marmot. Since then, I've seen 4 different species, Olympic National Park, Hoary, Mount Rainier National Park, Groundhog, Michigan, visiting you, and Yellow-Bellied, Rocky Mountain National Park. 4 different kinds of marmots in a month. I enthusiastically shared this with Karen, and she said, "No one cares. They're rodents." No one cares? I care. As soon as we reached Lone Pine Lake, we stood there looking at it for as long as it took to eat a granola bar, then turned around to hike back. Karen and I enjoyed the hiking part of the hike much more than the sitting and looking part. Karen says she wants to stop more often and enjoy the scenery on our hikes, but I've tested her on this. Any pause longer than 30 seconds brings a response of, "What are we doing? Are you ready to go?" The main reason Karen wants to keep moving is she doesn't like to pee on the trail. Many of our hikes are 3 to 4 hours long, and often the deciding factor in choosing our hike for the day is which one has a restroom at the end. I don't care where I pee. I'm fine peeing next to the trail. We've made a pact that whenever I stop to pee on a hike, Karen's job is to be the lookout. She's supposed to warn me of approaching hikers by calling out, "Whippoorwill, whippoorwill." So far, the only thing I've heard from her is heavy exhales. She's jealous that I can pee anywhere. She would prefer that I hold it in a show of solidarity until she can go also. We were lucky we didn't stay long at Lone Pine Lake. A few minutes after we headed for the car, we heard thunder, even though the sky was nearly cloud-free. We knew from growing up in the Midwest that afternoon thunderstorms can develop quickly, especially in the Rockies. We quickened our pace. Each time we heard thunder, we sped up more. A mile from the car, we were surprised to see hikers passing us going in the other direction with no raincoats, backpacks, or umbrellas, no rain gear of any kind. Some even had expensive cameras out of their cases and hanging around their necks. I could hear Karen behind me say softly, as if talking to the passing hikers, "It's cloudy, it's windy, there's thunder and lightning. You're going to be drowned rats in about 10 minutes." About a half mile from the car, we felt small drops and strong wind gusts. We knew we only had a few minutes before the heavy rain would reach us. The last 200 yards was a dash for the car through a downpour and small hail. We sat in the car, dripping wet, watching it rain and feeling the car rock back and forth from the wind. As strange as it sounds, we missed the Midwest thunderstorms. It was a perfect end to a perfect hike. Tomorrow we're driving to Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park. I have to confess, I don't know what a Gunnison is. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, number 6, Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park. Date, July 24th, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, we must look soft. Ranger Betty of the B.C. of the G. Visitor Center seemed to think so. We told her that we wanted to do the Gunnison Route hike from the rim of the canyon down to the river, but she strongly discouraged us. She listed many reasons why we shouldn't do that hike, emphasizing that even though it's 1 mile down to the river, it's a 1,800-foot vertical drop. It's so steep, the Park Service installed an 80-foot chain a third of the way down the trail to assist hikers. Betty tried to convince us that we weren't prepared for the hike by pointing out that we didn't have gloves, we weren't wearing long pants, and we didn't have the recommended gallon of water each. But we insisted on trying anyway. We thought, it's a short hike, how hard could it be? Also, when someone tells Karen she can't do something, it only makes her want to do it more. Hikers are required to get a backcountry permit and listen to an orientation talk before attempting this hike. Betty prepared our permit and then got out her notebook with the orientation script. She began to take us through the orientation. What plants we would encounter. Stinging nettle and poison ivy were my favorites. How to use the chain, etc. About 3 minutes into the orientation, Karen wandered off to look at postcards. Ranger Betty stopped her presentation, whistled to get Karen's attention, and motioned her back. This only deepened Betty's concern about us. Mostly Karen. Once Karen was with us again, Betty went over the animals we might encounter on the hike. She turned her notebook to a page with a picture of a black bear and a mountain lion. She first pointed to the mountain lion and said, "If you see this one, there's nothing you can do, so I'll tell you about the bear instead." Already we felt more confident. Betty told us about a black bear that frequents the trail and what to do if we came across him. After the orientation, we signed the backcountry permit and were free to do the hike. On the trail, we quickly learned why Ranger Betty tried to discourage us. The beginning of the trail was nearly vertical. We struggled in several places, trying not to fall and slide on our butts down the canyon, and we hadn't even gotten to the chain yet. After a quarter of a mile, we called it quits and climbed back up. We had to use our hands to pull ourselves up the trail, grabbing tree trunks and roots. The hike lasted about as long as the orientation. Part of the deal with backcountry permits is you have to turn them back into the visitor center when you finish the hike so they know who to go looking for, rescue, at the end of the day. I snuck into the visitor center, hoping to slip the permit to the cashier in the bookstore and leave before Betty saw me. But as if on cue, Betty came around the corner as I reached the counter. I handed her the permit and silently blamed Karen by tilting my head toward the parking lot. Betty could see her standing out there, fixing her hair in the reflection of our car's window. There was no reason to let Betty think we're both lame. From the visitor center, we hiked the Flat Oak Loop, and then drove the rim road, stopping at many of the overlooks. The canyon is very steep and narrow. The views from the overlooks are impressive, but because of the steepness of the canyon, hikes are either flat along the rim or nearly vertical to the river. The rest of our hiking today was along the rim. It occurred to me as I looked into the canyon that most national parks are defined by what's there, a mountain, a lake, or the wildlife. But BC of the G National Park is defined by what's not there. A thin but incredibly deep chunk of the high plateau is missing. The Gunnison River carried it away. Because of the steepness of the canyon, it's a small park in terms of land that can be used for recreation, and there's not much close by. We stayed in the town of Montrose, 13 miles away, which was the closest lodging we could find. The canyon was a spectacular sight, especially today when it was clear and sunny. But unless you hike down to the river, it doesn't take long to see the park. We felt we did everything we wanted to in a few hours. By the way, Karen and I decided the name of the park is too long, so we've shortened it to the BC of the G. Tomorrow we're stopping in Telluride for the night, on our way to Mesa Verde National Park. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, number 7, Mesa Verde National Park. Date, July 26, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, the drive south from Telluride on Highway 145 this morning was spectacular. Around every turn there was a scene of red cliffs and dark green forest against a brilliant blue sky. We even saw a black bear by the side of the road. 10 miles east of Cortez, Colorado, in the southwest corner of the state, we came to the entrance of Mesa Verde National Park. Today was a bonus day for us. We weren't expecting to get to the park as early as we did. We drove straight to the Far View Visitor Center and signed up for tours of Balcony House and Cliff Palace. We also got tickets for tomorrow's Mug House and Longhouse tours. Our timing was perfect. There was just enough time to TCB before driving to Chapin Mesa for the Balcony House tour. TCB is short for Taking Care of Business, not to be confused with Doing Your Business, which is Karen's euphemism for going to the bathroom. Specifically, on our parks trip, TCB means 1. Taking our picture in front of the park sign, 2. Getting a copy of the park map and newsletter, 3. Stamping our passports, and 4. Buying 4 postcards, 1 for each of our kids and 1 for us. The only other requirement to make a park visit official is to do an activity like a hike or ranger-led tour. Balcony House was our first tour today. Our group met in the parking lot for an orientation talk with Jenny, the ranger who was our guide. She explained what we would see and warned us of the physical requirements of the tour. To enter Balcony House, each member of the group would have to climb a 32-foot wooden ladder. It sounded scarier than it was. Later, I asked Jenny if there had ever been accidents on the ladder, or if anyone ever needed to be rescued from Balcony House. I was surprised when she said that more than once a person with a heart condition climbed to the top of the ladder, then, after stepping into Balcony House, died of a heart attack. Jenny led us down a steep set of stairs built into the cliff adjacent to Balcony House. At the bottom was a locked gate. Before unlocking it, she turned to the group and said, "This is the last chance for anyone to chicken out gracefully. If you get to the ladder and don't want to climb it, everyone will have to wait while I walk you back to this gate and let you out. There were no chickens in our group. Inside the gate, a paved path led us to a spot just beneath Balcony House and to the foot of the access ladder. It was wide enough for two people to climb side by side. I imagined we would go up one at a time, but the ladder was tall enough for several of us to climb at the same time. Looking up, I was relieved to see only a couple of skinny kids above me, 60 pounders at the most. If they fell, they weren't likely to take me with them. Everyone on our tour made it up the ladder without incident. There were no falls or heart attacks. Balcony House was a medium-sized cliff dwelling. It had 40 rooms and 2 kivas. Some rooms were a few feet deep and wide, probably built for storage, while others looked large enough for a family to sleep in. A kiva is a room where communal or religious gatherings took place. They are usually round, with a floor several feet below ground level, with a place to make a fire. Balcony House faces east. It would have been a cold place to live in the winter. Because of the way they built it into the cliff, it was an easy place to defend, but a hard place to get into or out of in a hurry. Our exit included crawling through a narrow 12-foot tunnel. A big person would not be able to get through. Another reason for the orientation talk before the tour was to give Jenny a chance to size up the group, literally, and to encourage anyone who might be too big to make it through the tunnel to sit this one out. Once through the tunnel, we climbed another ladder. Then we scrambled back up to the mesa using the handholds and toeholds carved into the side of the cliff by the original cliff dwellers. Usually we don't like guided tours, but this one we enjoyed. Besides, going on a ranger-led tour is the only way to see most of the major cliff dwellings in the park. The Park Service does this to protect the sites from damage by visitors. Even the smallest wear and tear, multiplied thousands of times over the years, can do serious damage to the sites. After a quick lunch and a visit to the Chapin Mesa Museum, we got in line for our afternoon tour. Cliff Palace is the largest cliff dwelling in North America. It's a magnificent sight from the trail just below the parking lot. From a distance, it looks fake, like an architect's model, until a tour group files in to give it a sense of scale. I can only imagine what those cowboys thought when they first saw these houses. Cliff Palace was much easier to get into than Balcony House. It only required climbing a couple of short ladders, and there were no tunnels to crawl through. With 150 rooms and 23 kivas, the Park Service estimates that 100 people lived at Cliff Palace. Karen wanted to stay all afternoon, but the rangers kept us moving. There were more tours scheduled after hours. With the balance of the afternoon, we hiked the 2.5-mile Petroglyph Point Trail, which goes past one of the largest and best-preserved petroglyph panels in the Southwest. The petroglyphs were clearly visible in the bright afternoon sunlight. Spirals, handprints, zigzags, bighorn sheep, human stick figures, one with both arms overhead, another with its right arm up and left arm down. Standing in front of the panel, it was exciting to think that another person once stood in that same spot, in the case of these petroglyphs, no fewer than 700 years ago, scratching their design into the rock. It's as if the person just stepped around the corner a few minutes ago. On the petroglyph trail, we met Paula and Gary from Indiana. Later, at the Far View Lodge, we ran into them again and drank a beer together. They told us about all the parks they visited. It was an impressive list, even more so considering they drive to the mall. They don't like to fly. We told them about our plan to visit all 58 national parks. They were enthusiastic and encouraging. It's fun to connect with other fans of the parks. It gives us the energy to keep going. Bob and Sue, it's not too late for you to join us. Your friend, Matt. Cliff dwellings are the main attraction at Mesa Verde. There are more than 600 of them in the park, but most are not open to the public. The Pueblo Indians constructed them from about the years 550 to 1300, although the golden age of cliff dwelling in the area was from 1100 to 1300. Archaeologists can tell that the majority of cliff dwellers left abruptly at the end of the 13th century, probably as a result of a 24-year drought and the stress of overpopulation on the mesa. Most of the dwelling sites are located under eroded areas beneath cliffs. This protected the inhabitants from the weather and from one another. In 1888, two cowboys reported finding cliff dwellings on the mesa, and from that moment, interest in the area grew quickly. Eventually, concerns about artifacts being removed and the potential for damage to the archaeological sites led to the establishment of the park in 1906. A petroglyph is a design, often prehistoric, carved into rock, not to be confused with a pictograph, which is a design drawn or painted onto the surface of a rock. From Matt Smith. Subject, Mesa Verde, Day 2. Date, July 27, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, the park newsletter describes the Mug House Tour as a strenuous 2-hour, 3-mile round-trip hike that includes steep drop-offs, switchbacks, and scrambling over boulders. That's code for, if you have to rock back and forth several times to build up enough momentum to get your ass out of your car, don't sign up for this tour. It's a weed-out tactic. The tour is a ranger-led, limited-time-only hike that the park just started offering to test the level of public interest. This morning we took the 10 a.m. tour. There were 9 of us on the hike, including the 2 rangers. We were happy to visit this remote cliff dwelling with such a small group. It was sunny and cool, a perfect day for a hike. From the parking lot we walked about a quarter of a mile along the paved road where we found the trail to the cliff dwelling. We then left the road and walked down a trail through the scrubby, desert-like landscape, watching for rattlesnakes that sometimes sun themselves in the open. After dropping down 100 feet in elevation, the path leveled, and then followed the contour of the cliffs until it reached Mug House. When explorers first entered these ruins, they found 3 mugs hanging in one of the rooms, as if the residents forgot them when they left in a hurry. That's how the site got its name. The ranger leading the tour had done her homework on Mug House. She and her husband are seasonal rangers and teachers during the rest of the year. She showed us how archaeologists could tell that various sections of the complex were built at different times because of the methods and materials used. She also explained how the cliff dwellers would recycle building materials. When they built the new complex, they got much of their building materials from tearing down older dwellings. This was all thoughtfully prepared and presented in a 3-ring binder with plastic page protectors for each exhibit. Karen and I enjoyed the Mug House tour very much. Being in a small group and a couple of miles away from the road gave it an intimate and authentic feel. In that setting, we could imagine what it was like for the early explorers of this area when they stumbled across these ruins. Hopefully the park will continue to offer these backcountry tours. By noon we were back at the parking lot where we began. Nothing about the hike seemed as strenuous as the newsletter suggested. There was just enough time to eat lunch in our rental car and do a self-guided tour of Step House before our 1 p.m. Longhouse tour. A tram from the parking lot took our Longhouse tour group of 40 a few miles along a paved path to a staging area. Longhouse was the most picturesque dwelling we visited, partly because the lighting was perfect when we were there. The site faces west, and when the afternoon sun hit it, the red stones against the green vegetation make it a striking scene. When the late 19th century explorers discovered these ruins, they were jumbles of stones. Centuries of silt obscured most of what was beneath. Now they've been carefully unearthed, but many of the walls remain in mid-crumble, their stair-step edges suggesting where the complete walls once were. The Park Service has made modest repairs to some of the structures, but nearly everything visible at the cliff dwellings is from the period of the Pueblo Indians. Longhouse was beautiful, but the ranger leading the tour was a bonehead. If he only pointed and grunted, the tour would have been more enjoyable and educational. A huge difference from the tour this morning. Most rangers we encounter in the parks are dedicated, enthusiastic, and do a great job on the tours. This guy must have slipped through the screening process. At the beginning of the tour, he chose a 12-year-old girl from the group and played, "Let's pretend you're an Indian girl and you're getting ready for your wedding." The Pueblo Indians married young 700 years ago. She had to choose a boy from the group to be her husband, which was awkward and kind of creepy. The rest of the tour involved asking the two of them questions like, "What food would you serve at your wedding?" while the rest of us stood around listening to them guess wrong answers. The only thing I hate more than audience participation is guessing games. If the ranger wants us to know that the Pueblo Indians ate beans, corn, and squash, then just tell us. The tour was painful and inappropriate, but the sight was beautiful. They should make this a silent tour. During one of the guessing sessions, I instinctively stood up. I had to get away. Karen looked up and whispered, "Where are you going?" "Back to the car. I wasn't invited to the wedding." She grabbed my leg and said, "You're not going anywhere." She was right. There was no way out. We were a few miles from the parking lot, and the tram would not be back for another 45 minutes. I just had to tough it out. After the longhouse tour, we drove back to Far View Lodge. Mesa Verde is a beautiful park to drive through. It's a plateau ranging from 7,000 to 8,000 feet in elevation. Juniper and pinyon trees normally cover much of the park, but 9 sizable forest fires over the last 100 years have wiped out many of them. The ranger told us that the regrowth cycle for juniper trees after a fire is about 250 years. At 400 years, the juniper and pinyon tree forest gets so thick it's susceptible to a major fire, usually caused by lightning, and so the cycle continues. 2 fires in the year 2000 burned more than 28,000 acres in the park. We could still see the impact of those fires today as we drove through the park. As we were driving to the lodge, a heavy thunderstorm blew in. It was perfect timing. We'd finished our day of tours and welcomed the cool break. We ate at the lodge restaurant for the 2nd night in a row. It was fantastic. Indian rugs on the walls, professional wait staff, and interesting menu items. I ordered the poblano rellenos that Karen ate last night. It's hard to find that kind of authentic southwestern cooking in Seattle. Your friend, Matt.
From Karen Smith. Subject, number 8. Great Sand Dunes National Park. Date, July 28, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, walking from the parking lot onto the sand at Great Sand Dunes National Park was like stepping onto a beach minus the ocean. There were people in swimming suits lounging in beach chairs, toddlers running around in diapers, and kids building sandcastles and throwing frisbees. It didn't seem like we were in South Central Colorado. In the spring, Medano Creek runs between the parking area and the eastern edge of the dunes. In May, there can be surge flows. Sand creates small dams upstream in the creek, and when the water breaks through, waves up to 12 feet high flow downstream. In wet years with high runoff, people float, surf, and skimboard down the waves. We heard that the creek area is crowded during these weekends, causing lines of traffic and overflowing parking lots. The creek bed was dry today, but the beachgoers didn't seem to mind. The Great Sand Dunes are the tallest dunes in North America. Rising in front of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, they're a dramatic sight. We stopped at the visitor center first, and then set off to hike to the top of one of the dunes, about a 700-foot rise, in the middle of the afternoon. This was a serious lapse of common sense. In the summer, you should avoid the dunes during the afternoon. The ranger at the visitor center told us this, but we ignored her advice. The air temperature is brutally hot, and, of course, the sand gets even hotter. The surface temperature on the dunes can reach 140 degrees. We were also starting at a high elevation, 8,200 feet, which meant we were breathing heavily just walking through the parking lot. Minutes into the hike, the wind started blowing sand into our eyes and faces. It stung our bare arms and legs. It was all very painful. We had to close our eyes to keep the sand from blinding us. The sand stuck to our sweat, which for me was pretty much everywhere. Walking was slow and difficult. With every step, our feet would sink and our shoes filled with sand. We tied our shoelaces as tight as possible, but the sand found a way in regardless. Eventually, there was no room in our shoes for our feet and toes to move. Every few minutes, we had to take off our shoes, balance on one foot, because it was too hot to place the other foot on the sand, and dump out the sand. There was no way to keep the sand out. Occasionally, I would pry open my eyes to see where I was going. I could barely make out the shape of Matt's body ahead in the sandstorm. I did my best to keep up with him, but I was miserable. The only thing that kept me going was envisioning how much younger my face was going to look with the top layer of skin sandblasted off. The sand dunes kicked our asses. We didn't make it to the top. On our way back to the car, we saw people having way more fun than we were. They were sandboarding and sledding on the dunes, dragging everything from snowboards to cookie sheets with them. Some were also dragging their dogs. They must not have seen the signs warning that dogs shouldn't be on the dunes after 11 a.m. in the summer because their paws will burn on the hot sand. Dogs can't tell their owners when their paws are on fire. We learned a few hard lessons today. Our negative experience wasn't because it's a bad park. It was due to our poor planning. Matt says, "I'm his research assistant. He should fire me." I wish we would have allowed ourselves another day to spend in this park. The mountains and forests surrounding the dunes are beautiful, and there are some great hikes we missed. And, of course, we should have hiked the dunes in the early morning or evening. Tomorrow morning we're heading to Lawrence, Kansas, to be with Matthew on his birthday. Along the way, we're planning to visit a couple of national park units. Bent's Old Fort National Historic Site, and Fort Larned National Historic Site. Then, if we have time during our stay in the Kansas City area, we'll go to Independence, Missouri, to visit the Harry S. Truman National Historic Site. Even though these sites aren't named national parks, we still enjoy visiting them when we can, so long as they have a stamp for our passports. Your friend, Karen.
From Matt Smith. Subject, Travel Day, to Holbrook, Arizona. Date, August 10th, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, Bob, you will appreciate this because you're cheap like me. At 5:54 a.m. this morning, we took the number 218 bus from the Issaquah Park and Ride to the International District in Seattle, where we caught the light rail to SeaTac Airport. The cost for the two of us was $6.50. That's one-tenth the cost of a taxi and way cheaper than parking at the airport. We flew to Las Vegas, where we picked up a rental car for the week. Our plan is to drive to Petrified Forest National Park, then to Grand Canyon National Park, and then back to Las Vegas to celebrate Karen's 50th birthday this weekend. On our way east to Holbrook, Arizona, we stopped in Flagstaff. Downtown Flag is what the locals call Flagstaff, has several decent outdoor gear stores. I found a backpack that I'd been looking for, and as I took it to the cashier, Karen reminded me that she had officially banned me from buying any more backpacks. I just bought one last month and have a couple of others. I explained to her, I can't have just one backpack. They're all different sizes and made for different activities. She said, you mean like purses? Why didn't you say that in the first place? Now I get it. A backpack is your man purse. I started to tell her that she didn't know what she was talking about and that she doesn't have authority to ban me from doing anything, but she was already gone. She was looking through the backpacks to see if there was one that matched my hiking boots. Earlier, when we were exploring the town, we'd stopped in the Lumberyard Brewery for a beer. Since we didn't know what restaurants we'd find in Holbrook, we headed back to the brewery and ate an early dinner. Flagstaff has everything we like in a city. It's a college town, high in elevation, with good breweries and endless outdoor recreation opportunities. We could live here. When we finished dinner, we drove to Holbrook and checked into the Travel Lodge. It's an older motel that looked sketchy on the outside, but the room was nice and clean and inexpensive. The person who checked us in was extremely helpful. He gave me a map of the area and showed me the quickest way to get to Petrified Forest National Park. If we're ever in Holbrook again, we would stay here. Karen went to bed at 8:30 p.m., 7:30 p.m. Pacific time. That's a new record. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, number 9, Petrified Forest National Park. Date, August 11th, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, when we got to the Petrified Forest National Park Visitor Center, I noticed that their passport stamp was misshapen and hard to read. I was hoping all the park stamps would be the same size, style, and quality so they would look orderly when I frame them together after our park's trip is complete. That's just O.C., right? No D? This didn't seem to bother Karen. I said to her, you didn't even notice that the stamp looked different from the others. That's the opposite of O.C. There should be a name for that. She said, there is. It's called normal. I don't think so. From the visitor center, we hiked about a half mile to the Painted Desert Inn. It was an interesting hike because of the amazing views of the surrounding painted desert. The colors were incredible. The inn is no longer structurally stable enough to allow overnight guests. Now it's a National Historic Landmark, and functions only as a museum and bookstore. You can look in the windows of the original guest rooms. They are small and primitive. There's a fantastic petroglyph of a mountain lion displayed inside the inn. The ranger in the gift store said that during construction of the inn, workers building the road flipped over the rock and found the petroglyph on the back. It makes me wonder how many great petroglyphs are out in the desert that will never be found. 10 miles to the south of the inn is Blue Mesa. It gets its name from the bluish bentonite clay on the mesa. We hiked the 1-mile Blue Mesa Loop. There we saw lots of petrified wood, but mostly in small pieces. Karen thinks the park should be named Petrified Pieces National Park because there is no forest. All the petrified wood is laying on the ground in pieces. I'm not bothered by this fact. Now who has the O.C.? The Puerco Pueblo ruins, just north of Blue Mesa, are the remains of a 100-room pueblo, occupied between 1,200 and 700 years ago. Close to the ruins we saw several petroglyphs near the paved trail. My favorite was one of a large bird with a baby in its beak. Not a baby bird, a baby human. No one knows why the bird has a baby in its beak. Karen is sure the bird was bringing a baby to a family, rather than carrying a baby away. I'm not so sure. We drove to the Rainbow Forest Museum in the southwest corner of the park. Behind the museum, we walked through an area with giant logs of petrified wood. The name of the trail is, surprisingly, the Giant Logs Trail. It takes visitors through one of the best-preserved areas of petrified wood in the park. The size and number of logs was amazing. Karen was more impressed with these specimens, but still wouldn't call it a forest. This area once had many more times the number of large petrified logs than it has today. Before the area became a national park, prospectors hauled away train carloads of petrified wood. Much of it was ground up for use as industrial abrasive. That's a real shame. I wish I could have seen this area before that happened. We wrapped up our visit early. We had a long drive to get to the Grand Canyon, where we're spending the night. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, Number 10, Grand Canyon National Park. Date, August 12, 2010. Dear Bob and Sue, yesterday on the way to the Grand Canyon, we stopped at the Cameron Trading Post because we'd heard it had a huge selection of Navajo rugs. It's on the Navajo Indian Reservation and has been an active trading post for nearly 100 years. The parking lot was full of tour buses, motorcycles, and cars with out-of-state license plates. The rugs were fantastic, but out of our price range, so we left empty-handed. Along the road from the trading post to the park's east entrance, there were roadside stands selling Navajo art and crafts. We stopped at a couple but didn't buy anything. It was so windy that the pottery on the tables wobbled constantly. I kept imagining having to buy an entire table of vases because we were standing there when a strong gust came by. Our first stop inside the park was the Desert View Lookout. The sun was setting, and the light was perfect. It was the golden hour. The views were amazing. It's the Grand Canyon, what can I say? Any description would be inadequate, so I'm not even going to try. It's a must-see wonder. We drove along the canyon rim, stopping at a few more overlooks. The Grand Canyon is overcrowded this time of year. We'd like to come back when there aren't so many visitors and when it's cooler. The rims of the canyon actually get a fair amount of snow in the winter. I imagine on a sunny day the colorful rock walls of the canyon dusted with snow are a magnificent sight. Our last stop yesterday was the Grand Canyon Village, where we ate dinner in the El Tovar Hotel Bar. The El Tovar Hotel is a prime example of a style of architecture called National Park Service Rustic. It opened in 1905 and sits at the edge of the south rim of the canyon. It's a classic lodge complete with dark log siding and animal heads in the great room. We tried to get a reservation to stay overnight in the hotel, but it sold out months ago, and we were too late in making our plans. Instead, we're staying at the Best Western just outside the southern entrance to the park. Before we finish our park's trip, we're planning to come back and hike rim to rim. This morning, however, we just wanted to do a half-day hike. We got to parking lot E in the village at 7:45 a.m., and we're hiking down Bright Angel Trail before 8 a.m. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. You want to get on the Bright Angel Trail early. A park concessionaire uses this trail to take people down the canyon on mules. They don't slow you down so much as they leave presents along the trail. Early in the day, there's less mule shit to step around. The hike to the canyon floor on Bright Angel Trail is about 7 miles. Today we were hoping to hike 4 miles down, but when we got to the 3-mile rest stop at 9 a.m., it was getting so hot we decided it was a good time to turn around. Since the hardest part of the hike is going uphill, we wanted to make sure we'd have enough energy to make it back. From our rest stop, we had 2,000 vertical feet to climb to get back to the top of the canyon. We rested for 20 minutes and then started our return. There's an abrupt attitude change when you switch directions on a steep hike. On the downhill, everything is right with the world. Steps are effortless and views are spectacular. You greet every passing hiker with a smile and good morning. Karen might even convince me to hold her hand and laugh now and then. But the way up is a trudge. Every other breath is a gasp. Your aching legs feel thick and heavy, and all you want to say to passing hikers is, "No, it's not a good morning. Stop smiling and get out of my way before I pass out." Hiking up the canyon, there's no bailing out. You have to make it to the top to get out. Time slows, and you lose perspective on how much farther you have to go. But on long hikes, we've found a reliable method of determining how close we are to the parking lot by looking at passing hikers. The first sign that we were getting close to the top was when we passed a husband and wife with 2 small children. The kids looked to be about 4 and 6 years old. The 4-year-old was making himself dizzy by twirling in circles with his arms straight out, the father trying to keep him from spinning off the side of the canyon, while the mother consoled the 6-year-old, who was sitting hunched over, arms crossed, and with tears running down his cheeks. That's as good of a 1-mile marker as there is on a trail like this. A short distance past the happy family, we stopped to take a drink. We were both sweating heavily and glad we'd brought plenty of water. I looked at Karen and said, "Nice red underwear." There was no response, just a confused look on her face. "Your white shorts are completely see-through." Karen sweated so much that her hiking shorts were transparent. That may explain why no one passed us on the way up the trail. I dug an extra T-shirt out of my backpack, Karen tied it around her waist, and we continued our death march to the top. Finally, I looked up to see a woman coming toward us wearing shiny gold flip-flops, designer jeans that were tight enough to be body paint, and a black T-shirt with the words, "Wine Tester," spelled out in bright red sequins. That was a sure sign we were less than a quarter of a mile from the car. We reached the top of the canyon well before noon. As soon as we were off the trail and on flat ground, we regretted not having gone farther down the trail. We had plenty of energy left. The Park Service warns people not to attempt hiking down to the bottom of the canyon and back up in the same day, but everyone needs to know their own fitness level and adjust that advice accordingly. Families with small children and wine testers certainly aren't going to make it, but a down-and-back hike in one day is doable for people in good shape. Still, I wouldn't try it in August, especially hiking with someone who's about to turn 50. Tomorrow we're driving to Las Vegas to celebrate Karen's birthday, and then next week we're off to Alaska. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, number 11, Glacier Bay National Park.